My name is Kasper Rasmussen, and this work is a joint work with my advisor, Sajin Kapkun. The title is Realization of RF Distance Bounding, and it's going to be about how we built and how we implemented a distance bounding protocol that meets all the properties of that you would expect from a distance bounding protocol. So a bit of background first. What is actually distance bounding? Well, distance bounding is a protocol that's run between two entities, a verifier and a prover. We call them the verifier and the prover and not Alice and Bob, because it's the verifier's job to verify a distance, and it's the prover's job to prove to the verifier that he's within a certain distance. So it kind of seems like good names. But it's the job of this protocol to measure an upper bound on the physical distance between the verifier and the prover. So the verifier is trusted. It doesn't really make sense to have an untrusted verifier, because the verifier is the one in the end who will end up with all the information. So he's sort of trusted by design. But the prover can be any device. The prover is untrusted, and it can be any device who has an incentive to prove to the verifier that he's close. So I'll get into exactly how this works, but first of all, I want to go through some properties. Now, the most important property of a distance bounding protocol is that the prover cannot prove or pretend to be closer than he really is. So this is a very important property that if it's broken, the whole protocol is sort of meaningless. He can prove to be further away if he wants to. We can't do anything about that, but he cannot prove to be closer. Now, if we turn that around and look at it from the verifier's point of view, we know that after we run the distance bounding protocol, the prover is within a certain distance. And why do we know that? Because if the prover was outside this circle here, he wouldn't have been able to prove that he was there, because that would have required him to prove that he was closer than he really is. So the verifier knows that he's within a certain circle. Now, what can you use a distance bounding for? Well, there are many suggested applications. Most of them have to do with some sort of access control to resources. So you can imagine an access point in a room where you only want to offer access to people in that room. And instead of relying on signal decay or other measures, you could actually run a distance bounding protocol with that access point and prove to the access point that you're close enough to be allowed to access it. Another application is contactless smart cards. If you want to open a door with a contactless smart card, then it makes sense for the door to know that you are in fact close to the door, and somebody's not just relaying messages between you and the door, or between rather the smart card and the door. And if you followed the rump session on Wednesday, you will have seen how to steal cars by performing a relay attack between the car door and the key. And this is also another application where distance bounding would certainly solve that problem. So there are some well-known attacks on distance bounding. And the ones I'm going to go through here today are distance fraud and mafia fraud. So distance fraud is what we call a malicious prover trying to shorten the measured distance to a verifier. A mafia fraud is then an external attacker who tries to shorten the distance measured between the verifier and the prover. Now, you notice that only shortening attacks are mentioned here. Again, it's possible for both a malicious prover or an external attacker to actually enlarge that distance, but we don't care about attacks like that, because there's nothing we can do. So these are the attacks. So any distance bounding protocol you would propose would have as a goal to protect against these attacks. So how does a distance bounding protocol work as a quick overview? Well, it's basically a challenge response protocol. The verifier sends a challenge to the prover. The prover does some processing on that challenge to be able to convince the verifier that he actually received it and not somebody else, and then he sends it back. The verifier then measures the time between sending the challenge and receiving the reply, and from that he can calculate the distance to the prover. Now, this processing function is the problem, basically, because it needs to be very, very fast. It needs to be there, first of all, otherwise the verifier wouldn't know if somebody who's not the prover would be closer and just reflecting the signal, or just sending something back. But it needs basically to take as little time as possible. And the reason for that is, suppose it takes a certain amount of time, and a malicious prover comes along who's able to perform that processing faster. That malicious prover could then essentially reply earlier than the normal prover could, making it seem as if he was closer to the verifier than he really is, which is one of the properties that we really don't want broken. So it turns out that in theory, if the attacker could perform this function in zero time, he could cheat by half the processing time. So that processing time should essentially or ideally be zero because, well, half of zero is zero, so that would close this window entirely. Zero is probably not possible because, well, there has to be some sort of processing, and processing in zero time is pretty hard, but that's sort of the goal, that's the benchmark to which we can compare, is this a good or a bad distance founding protocol, or is it close or not close to being perfect. So let's look a little bit at the processing functions. There's been tons of functions proposed, but by far the most common one is XOR. It was proposed in 93 by Branson Chaum, and there are 50 plus, if not more, publications that use XOR as a processing function. And they have minor variations, but they all work more or less like this. So the prover sends some commitment to the verifier to make sure that he can't change his mind about his nouns later on. The verifier then challenges the prover with individual bits. The prover takes those bits, demodulates them, XORs with a bit of his own, and sends it back to the verifier. And this happens a number of times equal to the length of the nouns, and in the end there's a signature that protects the whole thing. Now the idea here is the reason it looks like this is that the signature is considered a heavy duty or an expensive operation, so it's moved outside of the critical phase, it's moved to the end. Instead of being, and the time critical phase being sort of the period from transmission of the challenge to reception of the response. But in the time critical phase, we still have this XOR. And in fact, that's a problem. And hopefully I can convince you of that fact a little bit later on in my presentation. But I just want to highlight our contributions. We show that functions that require the prover to actually interpret the bit that they receive before replying to it, so that includes XOR, it includes selection, it basically includes everything that's been proposed so far, are not ideally suited for distance bounding applications. And maybe even more importantly, they're not needed for distance bounding applications. We show that a new function that we create that we call challenge reflection with channel selection, or CRCS because that's easier to say, is actually well suited for distance bounding, and it doesn't require the prover to interpret the bit before replying to it. We designed and implemented a prover that uses this function and was able to receive, process, and send in less than 1 nanosecond. So the whole procedure of receiving, applying some sort of a function, and sending it out again is less than 1 nanosecond. And then finally we designed a distance bounding protocol on top of this hardware and this function to be able to make the whole thing sort of cryptographically sound and make sure all the properties were there in the end. So that's what I'm going to present later on, or in this presentation. First of all, I'm just going to try to convince you that XOR is in fact slow, because I mean XOR seems pretty fast, but I will explain why it's really not fast enough. So here, what we see on this schematic is a representation of the path that the signal needs to take in the prover in order for the prover to apply any kind of function. So on the top left, the signal comes in, hits the antenna, goes through some amplification and filtering stages. Those are very fast. The delay there is pretty negligible. Now the problem comes in the detection and demodulation and AD conversion stage, because in order to demodulate a signal, you have to wait for an entire symbol to come in, then demodulate it, and then send the bit further on. And typically the width of a symbol is much, much, much higher than the carrier frequency. So it's typically on the order of microseconds, if not longer. After that, you have to do the actual XOR, which is fast, but still it involves taking, loading a value from memory, doing the XOR, and pushing it out to the radio. And then you have to do the whole thing backwards. You have to modulate the whole thing and amplify and send it out. The fastest radio that I'm aware of that can do this, does this, that you can actually go and buy, does this in 300 nanoseconds. Now, that might seem pretty fast, but 300 nanoseconds roughly corresponds to an error in distance, in the distance measurement of 50 meters. And if your application is access to an access point only in this room, if you can shorten your distance by 50 meters, you pretty much broke that application. Now, there's another radio being designed at the moment by a colleague of mine, and he managed to push the timing of this stage, or one way. This diagram below corresponds to the top half of the upper diagram, and this is about 50 nanoseconds. So he reduced the whole turnaround time to about 100 nanoseconds, which is better, but still, well, way more than 1 nanosecond. So the function we suggest is called challenge reflection with channel selection. And here's how it works. The verifier sends a challenge to the prover on channel zero. And the prover then, instead of demodulating and doing all this stuff, just reflects the same challenge on either channel one or channel two. So he doesn't need to process the incoming challenge in any way other than reflecting it on either channel one and channel two. And the prover's choice of channel then encodes a bit in his nouns. And you can see that below in a slightly different way. The top wave there is the challenge being sent by the verifier, and the two bottom or the two reply channels below is then the challenge on which the verifier receives the reflected challenge. And whether he receives it on reply channel one or reply channel two indicates to him whether or not the prover wants to transmit a one or a zero. Of course, when you add up the two reply channels, they should exactly add up to what was sent. And this is one of the things the verifier has to check in the end. But this makes the whole thing very efficient and very fast. And the way we implemented this was, well, here you can see a schematic of the implementation. And the signal comes in from the left and hits the left antenna. And the little graphs between all the symbols are a frequency representation of the signal. So first, just after the antenna, you have the signal coming in on some carrier frequency. It then goes into a mixer. And a mixer has the property of pushing a signal up and down in frequency by a certain amount, determined by the frequency of the local oscillator, which is the thing down below there. This is a completely analog device. It doesn't incur any noticeable delay. So after the mixer, we have two copies of the incoming signal, one pushed down a little bit and one pushed up a little bit in frequency, which essentially corresponds to moving it to a channel below the challenge channel and a channel above the challenge channel. It then passes through a high pass filter and a low pass filter to remove one of the copies so that we have one channel on each wire, and then we can select between these two using the value of the local nouns, of the prover's nouns. So once that is selected, there's an analog signal path from the incoming antenna all the way through the mixer and a filter and out through the outgoing antenna. And that's there's no delay stage there at all. It's basically one analog path from input to output. Of course, then the verifier then switches the value of NPI, which is the ith bit in the nouns once in a while. So that was the idea, and that was what we attempted to create. So the hardware we built looks something like this. In this case, the incoming signal is coming in from the right into a couple of amplifiers. And the local oscillator is coming in from the bottom through an attenuator just to match the signal strength in the mixer. And then it's getting mixed and sent out through the high-pass filter and the low-pass filter. Now the wire going out on the left and carries the would be the one that carries the signal to the transmitting antenna. The yellow wires are just power. So this is the setup. This is our prototype. As you can see, this is more or less one-to-one, I was about to say, but of course the size on my screen is slightly different than what you see. But the point is it's about yay big. I mean, it's not very big, but it's certainly bigger than if we could push this to an integrated circuit. And actually what we found was that the delay through this thing is more or less the speed of light in wire through the distance corresponding to the distance here. So it's just the propagation delay of the signal through the circuit. So what were our results? Well, we took an arbitrary waveform generator and generated a signal of the 3.5 gigahertz. We took two wires of equal length. One we attached directly to an input signal of an oscilloscope. That's the ground truth, the upper yellow signal there. The other one we attached to the input of our prototype, and then we attach the prototype directly to another input of the oscilloscope. So the difference in arrival time on the oscilloscope is the propagation delay through our prototype. And as you can see here, it's 0.888 nanoseconds. We did a bunch of experiments, and the average value is 0.912 nanoseconds with a standard deviation of about 60 picoseconds. So it's pretty stable. We have a wireless implementation as well, I should mention, but I'm not going to talk about it here. It's described in the paper. So now that we have an implementation of this CRCS function that works and has a very small turnaround time, we need to build a protocol on top of this. It basically works like it did before. There is a signed commitment in the beginning. There is the distance measurement phase. And then in the end, there's a signature. The signature is still outside the time-critical phase as it was before, but the thing to notice here, that there's no XOR in the time-critical phase. We still need to demodulate and interpret the value of the nouns from the verifier because we need it in the signature at the end, but we can do that sort of on the side, either after the time-critical measurement is done or sort of in a different processor on the side. So we took that XOR out of the time-critical phase, and that's what allowed us to go down to 1 nanosecond processing time. Sorry. The security analysis is, we protect against mafia fraud and distance fraud, as I mentioned in the beginning. And we also protect against any security issues that might be connected with the implementation of this CRCS function. The details is a little bit nitty gritty. It's all in the paper. I can just mention that the signatures, the mafia fraud detection is basically prevented via signatures, and that. The verifier checks that the prover's nouns corresponds to what was committed to in the beginning, and that what he receives is also what he sent out. All that stuff, all the things that you would expect the verifier to check. And that's pretty much it. In summary, we showed that the traditional distance bounding functions used for distance bounding are not ideally suited for the task, so we suggested a new function. And we're not saying that this is the one and only function that you can use for this, but the point to remember here is that the time critical phase should definitely not depend on the demodulation of the challenge. We designed and implemented a distance bounding protocol on top of this function with a processing time of less than 1 nanosecond. And this is the first implementation of a real radio frequency distance bounding protocol, in the sense that it's the first implementation that really has all the properties that you would expect from a distance bounding protocol. So there are other ranging protocols, but basically they don't have this property that you cannot cheat. Our implementation is less than 15 centimeters from being perfect, in the sense that 15 centimeters is at the moment the window of the attacker, if the attacker could do something in zero time. It's our strong belief that if we push this to an analog integrated circuit, we could reduce that window by quite a bit. And if you just remember a single thing from this presentation, then remember that distance bounding is now feasible in RF communication. And thanks a lot for your attention. And
Hi, Ian Goldberg, University of Waterloo. So your protection against the mafia attack, in your diagram you had that M was allowed, even if M is very close to the verifier, It still can convince the verifier that the prover is close.
Exactly.
But the prover is also allowed to be untrusted.
Yes.
And why can't the prover just share all its private information with the mafia, and then the mafia just pretends to be the prover?
Sure. That is possible. If the prover gives his sort of long-term private key to an attacker who's closer, then that attacker can pretend to be the prover. But I mean, you can argue that then the attacker is the prover, right? Because there's no other identification mechanism than a private key. So
right.
if I give you my private key, then you're me.
Right, exactly. So is it the case that in your model, when you're defending against a mafia attack, you assume the prover is what? Honest or just not colluding with the mafia?
No, but we just we exclude the possibility of giving away your keys because
because so the key is
I mean, yeah, there is another attack called the terrorist attack in which the prover only wishes to give away short-term secrets but not long-term secrets. I didn't include it here because it's sort of easy to defend against. You just do an XOR with your long-term secret so that if you give it your short-term secret away, you inadvertently give away your long-term secret as well.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Avishai Wall from Tel Aviv. I thought I saw that your implementation worked in a gigahertz.
Yeah, 3.5 gigahertz is the challenge, and the reply is then 500 megahertz above or below that.
Okay. So will that still work in the contactless smart card world where you're looking at much, much lower frequencies like 13 megahertz and climbs are really slow and you have very weak processors? Mm. So maybe the propagation delay and the processing of the signals is so long that you're looking at an irrelevant problem.
Well, the propagation delay of the signal doesn't change that much. But
the symbol times do.
Yeah, the symbol time is huge. And what's actually even worse is that because the signal oscillates so slowly, it's very, very hard to say when exactly did a symbol start and when exactly did a symbol stop. So we're using autocorrelation, and we suggest using autocorrelation in the verifier to find the exact point at which sort of the exact delay without having to look at a single edge, for instance. And in theory, it would still work in low frequencies, but for sure, engineering-wise, it would be very hard to get robust. I mean, I tried this setup with 350 megahertz signals in the beginning, just because somehow it was easier to deal with, and I couldn't really measure it nicely on the oscilloscope. I needed a pretty high frequency signal to measure it.
And that's still like one or two orders of magnitude higher than real systems.
I mean, what you would need is a powerful reader that certainly has a fast clock, but it would be difficult to do in lower frequencies, but not impossible.
I think it's still valid to, you know, even if you can get something that's accurate up to a few meters.
Yeah, sure.
In lower frequency, that's still a huge value.
Definitely. It will certainly defeat attacks like this car stealing attack where you steal somebody's credentials while he's in the supermarket. Yeah, thank you.
That was a very good presentation. Thank you. When you were showing your circuit diagram that included the mixer and you were basically mixing the signal into two different frequency bands, would a system that instead of having a mixer, would a system that just sort of modulated the signal on or off work? So this is just sort of an engineering point. You know, you might be able to get rid of the mixer and just have a modulation based on turning the signal on and off. So, you know, that does mean that sometimes you're not actually transmitting the, you're not reflecting the response, so there'll be these blank periods. But over a long period of time, if all the positive signals correlate, then it would still be very hard for an attacker to get an advantage.
Yeah, sure. Basically, you would reduce by half what the attacker would have to guess in order to send a signal back that he didn't receive. And you would also, there are several other options. You could also invert the signal or push it 180 degrees. That's also something we've been thinking about. Like I said, this is not meant to be sort of the only option. The point is just that you can't start doing demodulation and stuff like that in the signal path.
What did he use for the source of entropy for the nonce?
Sorry, what?
What did he use for the source of entropy for the nonce?
For the source of the nonce?
How did he create the nonce?
We had an arbitrary waveform generator creating the signal, essentially, and sending it out. So, thanks. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.